You're listening to HuntertonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located in the CenturyLink building at 14 Mine Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programming.
To normal after crippling snowstorms, but the National Weather Service says temperatures in New England are expected to dip way below zero today.
While it'll be cold again and much below normal, it won't be quite as cold as the punch from last week.
That was meteorologist Jim Hayes from the National Weather Service. More violence in Ukraine. A Ukrainian military spokesman says continued attacks from rebels are delaying the pullback of heavy weapons from the front lines. But under the peace agreement reached earlier this month, both sides are supposed to withdraw. This is USA Radio News.
Kid, let me paint you a picture. Tuesday night, your cog belt goes bust. Who will help you get what you need fast? Without the hoops, hurdles, or headaches? Granger, that's who. I love Granger. They got a wide variety of products and solutions. Granger makes it easy to get everything we need. And answers for when we're not sure what the answer is. Now, kid, let me paint you another picture. It looks like a mop, a basement bathroom, and you, all over it. Get it? Got it? Good. Call clickgranger.com or stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Birdman won Best Picture last night at the Oscars, and its director also took home the trophy.
I think once I finish a film, I feel a successful filmmaker to be able to be, you know, to be lucky enough to finish a film. That thing is much more than the award that can receive.
That was Alejandro Iñárritu. American Sniper was mostly snubbed, only winning for sound editing, as was Selma, which won for original song. West Coast seaports are bustling this morning following Friday's tentative deal struck between employers and dock workers. Now the workers are clearing the backlog caused by a month-long contract dispute, and for the larger ports, the job could take months to complete. The brother of Kayla Mueller, the American aid worker who was killed after spending months as a hostage of the Islamic State terrorists, says her situation worsened after the U.S. traded five Taliban commanders for a captive U.S. soldier. He told NBC's Today show that the militants' demands got greater after the May swap for Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. U.S. home sales have plunged to the slowest pace in 9 months. The National Association of Realtors says they tumbled 4.9% last month, but Lawrence Yoon, chief economist, says that he expects a turnaround.
The factors to boost home sales, improving economy, job creation, still low mortgage rates, and also for renters, rents are also rising very strongly.
Meanwhile, median home prices increased 6.2% over the past 12 months to $199,600. I'm Kelly Sloan, and you're listening to USA Radio News.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
The weather today is mostly sunny with a steady temperature around 17 degrees. Northwest winds around 15 miles per hour. And tonight will be mostly clear with a low around -4. I did read that right. Northwest winds 5 to 14 miles per hour. Tuesday will be mostly sunny with a high near 21. Wind chill values as low as -7. Calm wind becoming south 5 to 9 miles per hour in the afternoon. Tuesday night will be mostly cloudy with a low around 17. South winds around 6 miles per hour. Wednesday, partly sunny with a high near 33. It's getting warmer. West wind 6 to 13 miles per hour. And Wednesday night will be partly cloudy with a low around 8. Welcome to Mental Health Matters. I'm Larry Cartwright, your host, and I'm very privileged today to have with us two very attractive young ladies. This is NAMI's hour, and for those of you that don't know, NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And there is a NAMI chapter in every county in the state of New Jersey, every state in the union, and overseas. In Hunterdon County, we are all volunteers. We don't have a office. We work out of our houses, that sort of thing. And I have to remember, my wife told me, I better not forget, that this coming Thursday at 7 o'clock, my wife and I are going to teach a 12-week course that is totally free to anyone who has a relative, blood relative, distant relative, whatever, suffering from mental illness, or it can be a best friend, or it can be a friend or an acquaintance. Doesn't have to be blood. And it's totally free, and it runs for 12 weeks at 52 East Main Street. It starts at 7 o'clock, but you must register. So if you would, you can call either Priscilla or myself, Larry, at 908-735-4465. We also run support groups for families, try to get them to little help get through their rough spots. We also try to educate the teachers, because a lot of times with younger folks, the teachers are the first ones to spot something because of the economic situation. The parents, both parents may be working or whatever. So anyway, that's pretty much NAMI in a nutshell. But we are very privileged today to have with us a veteran who's been on before, Robin Marks, who's the community outreach director at Princeton House. I know why she's community outreach, because Robin likes to talk. I'm only kidding, Robin.
Yes, hi, Larry.
Yeah. We're also very privileged to have with us Dr. Mindy Parisi. Did I say that right?
That's correct.
Okay. She is the director and specializes in eating disorders at Princeton House. Now, Robin, why don't you just briefly tell us what Princeton House is, for those that may not know.
Okay. Thank you, Larry. Good to see you again.
Nice to see you, too. And I won't ask you how it got started by, what's her name then?
Kitty Carlisle.
Kitty Carlisle. I won't ask you. I won't ask you. Every time she comes on, Mindy, I ask her about Kitty Carlisle and how it started, you know. But
About 42 years ago, the Princeton Medical Center downtown Princeton was just a small community hospital. And they were looking for a place for those with behavioral health issues. Mm-hmm. So they found a nursing home that Kitty Carlisle used to own, and they purchased that and began their first inpatient hospitalization program through that site, which was about 2 miles from the medical center. And 42 years ago, the face of mental health was a little bit different.
Exactly.
It had two units. It had a mental health unit and an addiction unit. And the length of stay ran 6 to 8, 12 weeks. People would come with suitcases filled with clothing. They'd go home on the weekends for passes. And then as time progressed, now we're a 110-bed inpatient psychiatric facility with psychiatric dual and detox facility, addiction recovery, and we specialize now in first responder program that those people that are firefighters, EMTs, police officers that might need just some stabilization due to the trauma of the work they're in, utilize our facility. And because the stay in our inpatient is so short, we now utilize outpatients. So we have 4, soon to be 5, outpatient centers that each center run anywhere from 10 to 15 programs, depending on the population in need.
And there are various locations around the state, or
close to Princeton House, but okay. We have North Brunswick, Princeton, Hamilton, and Morristown.
Okay.
Soon to open up the women's program in Tittenn Falls, and then just a solely women's program in Princeton.
Okay. What is the average inpatient stay then?
It depends on the diagnosis and the need.
Yeah, obviously, but I mean, you know, in general.
I'd say 8 to 10
okay.
days.
Okay. And then they're put into the outpatient and then facilities and...
Exactly. You stabilize them inpatient, then you titrate down their level of care, so then you'd go into a partial hospitalization program, which it's 9 to 3, so the patient can go home at night and have the family feel it all out, and then they come the next day, and you try that for hopefully about 2 weeks, and you have family sessions during that time, and you have case conferences, and make sure that all the needs of the patients are being addressed, Then you go into IOP, which is 3 hours a day, 3 days a week.
Okay.
So a whole episode of treatment.
Now, your IOP, is that involuntary outpatient?
No.
Okay, there's a difference, right?
Yes.
Okay, because I know somebody that Flemington or Huntington County just got a grant, and they put it in, I guess, I don't want to say September, somewhere around there, for involuntary outpatient.
No, all of our, even our inpatient is voluntary, except for a few short-term care beds that we contract with the state with. But every, all programs have to be voluntary.
So your IOP is, stands for what?
Intensive Outpatient Program.
There you go.
There you go. I know.
I love them all. When I was on a mental health board, they gave us a book with all these acronyms.
Right.
I looked at the lady and I said, "You for real? You know, you really think I'm going to remember all these?" You know, but everybody uses them, so I guess mm-hmm. you know. Dr. Parisi, usually I'm not an expert on it, but usually when I have people on the show who specialize in a specific field, mm-hmm. they either took that course to go into that field because of either personal or family that suffered from an illness or the thing, or a friend, you know. In your circumstance, why did you go for, you know, eating disorders?
You know, that's actually a hard question for me to answer, and I thought about that. And I can't point to any particular reason that I became interested in eating disorders. It's just something that I always had an interest in from the
okay.
time I was in college, and just continued that interest through my graduate career and, you know, when the opportunities presented themselves.
Yes, it's ironic because I will have someone on down the road who also does cutting and is a therapist for cutting mm-hmm. and, you know, eating disorders and binging and yeah, have you. And she wrote a book, and I'm in the middle of reading it. So before I read it, before she comes on, so I know what she's talking about. But she herself suffered from it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like she wrote it because mm-hmm. she went through it, you know. Mm-hmm. And it, but I was just curious. It's you
yeah,
know,
it's like I said, it's difficult. I've often been asked that. It's actually easier for me to say why I continue to be interested in eating disorders. And I
okay,
think it's
why
just,
do you continue to be?
Because I think it's such a complicated illness. It kind of defies logic in a lot of ways when you think about, you know, starving oneself. And it has so many different factors that play a role in it in terms of its impact on other people, its impact on the family system, its the medical consequences that come of it. You know, we were talking about Princeton House, and the eating disorders program is actually located in the medical hospital because
okay.
they have such significant medical complications. So that allows us to treat both the behavioral health aspects of the illness as well as the medical pieces.
And for those of us who are not as intelligent in this field, what exactly is an eating disorder?
Sure. Well, there's different kinds of eating disorders. Anorexia nervosa is one of the eating disorders, and the hallmark of anorexia nervosa is essentially restricting of one's energy intake relative to their needs. So either restricting food intake or over-exercising, resulting in a weight that is too low for that particular individual. Typically, it's weight loss, but it might be failure to gain weight if it's a child, for example. As they are growing, they should be gaining weight. So sometimes you see it manifested that way.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's low weight compared to what the person really should kind of be for their age, their height, their body
right.
type, that kind of thing, coupled with an intense fear of gaining weight despite the fact that the person is not overweight. And some distortion in the way they experience their weight and shape.
You know, we do presentations. We do a monthly one to educational services. And the lady I do it with, she's into all this technical jazz. Mm-hmm. So she does this PowerPoint thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one section of the PowerPoint that we talk about as a young man who at the age of 22 weighed 98 pounds. And died while he was doing his nightly 1,000 sit-ups.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And his mother didn't realize that he was so thin, and you saw pictures of him like previous or, you know, a couple years earlier and then there. But you stop and think, and people say, you know, in the audience, well, why didn't the mother know? Well, the kid is 22 years old. I mean, she's not watching him get dressed or undressed or whatever, you know. And, you know, it's just sad. You know, it really is. And
it is. And anorexia in particular has one of the highest mortality rates of any of the psychiatric illnesses.
I just can't imagine doing 1,000 sit-ups a day. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, yeah, I can't imagine doing 10 a day, but, you know, that's me. But 1,000 a day, I mean, you think about it, that's just awesome.
That can be one of the warning signs, actually, for anorexia, is this rigid, right, compulsive exercise. Sometimes you'll see people exercising, you know, despite, you know, poor health, despite, you know, they may be outside running, despite bad weather. It's this really compulsive aspect to it.
What about, I don't know if this is the same or different, what about people who eat and then force themselves to throw up?
Yeah, so bulimia nervosa is an eating disorder that is characterized by kind of extremes of eating, eating large quantities of food, binge eating, or eating large quantities of food a discrete period of time, followed by some kind of inappropriate compensatory behavior to prevent weight gain. So we probably most commonly think of self-inducing vomiting. But there are other kinds of compensatory behaviors that people engage in, again, to try to prevent weight gain. You may see laxative abuse. You may see compulsive exercise, kind of binging, right, followed by, you know, this stretch of very prolonged intensive exercise, fasting, that kind of thing.
Are there some symptoms that people, you know, warning signs or something, or symptoms that if you have a child and they're doing X, well, you got to be concerned?
I think, you know, for anorexia, certainly weight loss, particularly in over time or even particularly in a short period of time, is certainly a red flag, especially in children. Children should be gaining weight as they're growing. So when you see weight loss in children, that should raise some red flags. But certainly even older adolescents and adults, when you see weight loss, that can be one of the factors. You may just see signs of restrictive eating. The person may make excuses to avoid having meals with family, friends, things like that. So they may tell their friends, oh, I'm not going to eat with you because I've got such and such going on. And then they come home and I am not going to eat dinner because I ate at school. So there's excuses to, you know, to avoid eating. Or sometimes people will avoid social events where food is going to be present, things like that. You may see dressing in a lot of layers to hide the weight loss. You mentioned the young man whose family wasn't aware of how bad his weight loss was. And people may go to some lengths to kind of hide it sometimes.
How common is it?
You know, it's hard. You read different studies as far as, you know, what the prevalence looks like, how common it is. So it's hard to get a great read on that. But there's a continuum. So you've got kind of your full-blown eating disorders at the one end, and then you've got kind of these kind of subacute behaviors. So if you kind of take them together, there's a lot of people who are struggling with those kinds of symptoms. The number of people with a full-blown eating disorder is certainly smaller, but those kinds of concerns are, I think, unfortunately becoming more and more common, not just in women and girls who we tend to associate more with eating disorders, but as you mentioned, in men and boys as well.
Right.
And I think the numbers there are growing too.
Right. That's my question down the road about, you know, symptoms for men and boys.
Yeah.
Is there any specific cause for eating disorders?
That's a great question. And the short answer is
you can give a long answer if you want.
The short answer is we really don't know what that is yet. We don't have a great handle as a field on what the etiology is. Now, the long version is it's probably a combination of a lot of factors, but I think there's a very strong biological component. We're understanding that better and better, that there seems to be a strong biological component. You see eating disorders running in families. You see certain personality traits that might be vulnerability factors for people, like perfectionism, kind of obsessiveness and that kind of thing. And so that kind of creates perhaps a vulnerability factor for some people that then may get triggered by the experience of dieting. And we certainly are in a culture where dieting is seen as normative.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of cultural pressures to look a certain way, I think especially for women, but also for men and boys increasingly. That's not to say that those cultural pressures cause eating disorders.
No, right.
But it certainly creates a context in which that's a an activity that gets pursued that then for some vulnerable individuals gets taken on much too far. So it's kind of your old, you know, genetics loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger kind of thing.
Mm. Okay, we had talked about that when we met earlier, mm-hmm. you know, and because you had asked me if I was, and I, you know, I go to the gym, but, you know, then I go home, but not really. I've gotten a lot better. I used to eat, I don't want to even say how much. And it's so funny because when I come out of the service, I was like, you know, rail thin, you know. Mm-hmm. But over the years. And now it's like I go and I'll lose 5 pounds and gain 3, and I'll lose 4 and gain 6, you know. And I'll go like up and down the scale, and it just drives me insane. But, you know, I figured at my age I'm, you know, it's like, okay, you know. There are types of treatment that are available, mm-hmm. I would assume.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Are they effective?
They are. You know, one of the things is, you know, we may not have a full handle on the causes of eating disorders, but it doesn't mean we don't have effective treatments. And that parallels things in the medical field, too, where we don't always have full knowledge of what causes, say, cancer or something. Uh-huh. But we have treatments that are effective for it. So we do have effective treatments for eating disorders, particularly family-based interventions for people with anorexia nervosa, some of the cognitive therapy, interpersonal therapy for bulimia nervosa. So there are a number of...
What is interpersonal therapy?
That's a treatment that kind of focuses on just that, kind of the interpersonal aspects of the disorder, and kind of takes the focus off of the symptoms per se, and kind of looks at some of the interpersonal issues that are thought to be perhaps underlying.
Are the treatments that are available to us, are they effective?
They are, but I think that we also have to recognize just how difficult eating disorders can be to treat. So one thing that's really important when it comes to treatment of eating disorders is the earlier you can intervene, the better. And that's probably true of most things, but certainly it's true of eating disorders that if you can intervene before they become entrenched, the outcomes are much better. Early intervention, significant family involvement, things like that are associated with better outcome.
When someone has a disorder like this that we're talking about, some eating disorder of some sort, and they go into treatment, mm-hmm. and they want treatment, mm-hmm. Do you find that, like a lot of, we do a lot with mental health issues, and you see a lot of times they fall off, I don't want to say the wagon, but they fall off their course that they were given to, you know, proceed to live with their mental health issue. Do you find that people with eating disorders do the same and go off and go back on and go off and
they
go back
can.
On?
There's certainly a significant relapse rate for people with eating disorders. Some people can, you know, again, it's a continuum. So some people can go into a treatment setting. Some people can go into, for example, an outpatient treatment setting and do fairly well and be able to be treated at that level of care. Others may well need an inpatient level of care because either their symptoms are so out of control or they've got such significant medical complications or their weight is so low that they need the structure of an inpatient program in order to begin the process of gaining weight. And there's a subset of folks who, for whatever reason, after any treatment, do need to be readmitted at that level of care or another level of care or experience significant relapses. The good news is that people can and do recover, though, even despite those setbacks.
Right. Do you find that people with eating disorders also cut?
Some do. I wouldn't say it's a one-to-one kind of thing, but there is a subset of people with eating disorders who do engage in that kind of self-mutilating behavior, particularly when you think about it as, you know, the average age of onset for eating disorders is adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a behavior. Cutting is also a behavior that you start to see in adolescence. So there's a certain amount of overlap there.
It's scary because... up until recently, I used to work one day a week at the hospital on Saturdays in emergency services, and I would go for an hour or so to 2 Central, which is their lock ward in the hospital. And I was talking to somebody there, and well, I was talking to a group, and then after the group, this young man came up to me, and I guess I'm guessing at age. I don't know what his age was, but I'm guessing like 22, 23. And he said to me, and we were talking, and he said to me all of a sudden, I want you to see something. And with that, he pulled his sleeves up on both arms. There wasn't a piece of skin that didn't have scars on it, front, back, you know, all the way up to his elbows, and maybe further, but he only pulled his sleeve up to his elbows on both arms. And I was just like, I was shocked. Yes, I heard of cutting. Yes, I know people who cut. But usually it's not to that extent, you know. And so we talked a little bit, and I got him to, you know, talk to have a therapist come in and talk to him, and he agreed. So hopefully he's still doing that. But I was so amazed. I just was – I'm not normally shell-shocked and lack for words. I was my mouth just dropped open, and I didn't know what to say, you know. And it was just so sad, you know. He's not a bad-looking young man, and, you know, I wouldn't say he was thin. He was, you know, for his size and everything, he was like 5'7", so he was pretty much, I would think, in his weight for that size. But evidently something was going on, you know, and it's a shame. Pardon me. When you have someone who has a mental as an eating disorder, are there chances that they also have mental health issues?
You know, a lot of people with eating disorders have additional mental health issues, such as mood disorders or anxiety disorders, particularly when you see people at the inpatient level of care. There may be other things going on as well. So we see a lot of depressive disorders, a lot of mood disorders, a lot of anxiety disorders. Now, when you have someone with an eating disorder who also has depression, it's a little bit of which came first, the chicken or the egg, because when your nutrition is so disruptive, your mood often gets very dysregulated as well. So you kind of have to see, okay, well, is this a result of the eating disorder behavior? Is it a result of starvation and malnutrition? Or is it something that's going along with it? And so typically, we might give a little bit of time, you know, refeeding the person and see how they do as they start to increase their calorie intake and see, is this a comorbid mood condition or is it a result of the eating disorder? Now, what's interesting is with anxiety disorders, we see that a lot in people who have anorexia nervosa in particular. And what's interesting about anxiety disorders is, and the data is pretty clear on this too, is that the onset of the anxiety disorders does appear to precede the eating disorder. So there may be some kind of shared vulnerability there to both anxiety and to eating disorders.
And it would also depend, I would think, on the level of anxiety, because I just think about everybody has anxiety at one point in their life or numerous times in their life. And I think it's just a matter of, you know, I mean, you may be worried about a job interview or, you know, maybe wondering if the bank is going to loan you money to buy the house or that sort of thing. And we all have that.
Right.
Just like, you know, I tell people that every one of us, I think, suffers some kind of depression at one point in time. You know, whether we're depressed about breaking up with our girlfriend or we, you know, cracked up our new car or whatever the case may be. But I think it's a matter of how long the depression lasts before it becomes, you know, an illness and not just an emotion we're going through. So it's just, you know, like you said, what comes first, the chicken or the egg?
You know? Yeah, and you raise a good point that, you know, kind of clinical anxiety and clinical depression versus kind of the emotions that we often label as anxious or depressed being very different. But anxiety disorders like obsessive compulsive disorder, social anxiety, we see a lot of that in people who have eating disorders.
We're going to have to take a quick break. You've been listening to Mental Health Matters, and we're very privileged today to have with us Robin Marks, who's the outreach community outreach for at Princeton House, and Dr. Mindy Parisi, who is the director of eating disorders at Princeton House. And we'll be back in just a few moments.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
Rab Coins of Flemington, New Jersey has been in business for over 37 years. We are highly competitive buyers of gold, silver, and platinum coins, jewelry, and scrap metals, and have recently been named the exclusive gold buyer for Diamond Nation and HealthQuest. We also provide professional appraisal, sales, and liquidation services for individuals, law firms, estate trustees, and bank trust departments in New Jersey and Philadelphia. Products and services include gold and silver, American and foreign coins, certified rare date and modern coins, numismatic supplies and books, gold, silver, and platinum bullion, paper currency, United States proof, and mint sets, including current issues. From junior collector to the experienced investor, Rab Coins has been for numismatists since 1974. Founder and owner, Randy Block, an expert numismatist, has been an active member of the coin industry for over 45 years. Visit us at 56 Main Street in historic downtown Flemington or call toll-free 1-800-819-9875.
Hi, this is Ruth Ann Disatel, celebrant officiant with Celebration of a Lifetime. When people ask me why I joined the Chamber, it's because I want to get to know you and what you're all about. And I want you to get to know me and what I'm all about. And together, I'd like to celebrate what we can do for Hunterdon County.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce is a Forward New Jersey Coalition member.
London Bridge is falling down, falling down, falling down. London Bridge is falling down.
In August 2007, the I-35 bridge in Minneapolis collapsed, killing 13 people and injuring 145, including little children trapped on a school bus. The bridge had been rated structurally deficient, but those warnings were ignored.
Build it up with iron and steel, iron and steel.
In New Jersey, there are 479 bridges carrying over 8 million vehicles a day, rated worse.
Iron and steel will bend and bow, bend and bow, bend.
These aren't just bridges waiting to be fixed. They're tragedies waiting to happen. On June 30th, the state's transportation fund will be empty. We need to replenish it now, because next time, it could be your family on that bridge. Go to ForwardNewJersey.com and find out how you can help. Paid for by Forward New Jersey.
Welcome back to Mental Health Matters. I'm Larry Cartwright, your host, and we're very privileged today to have with us Robin Marks, who's the community outreach person at Princeton House. And we're also very privileged to have Dr. Mindy Parisi, who is the director of eating disorders at Princeton House. And we've been discussing various disorders and side effects and et cetera. Now, doctor, when someone has decided to seek help, what should they do? Besides call Princeton House,
1-800.
Yeah, well, we'll give you the time to do. We'll give you time to do the numbers and everything after.
Again, it really depends on where they are on that continuum. Some people can benefit from traditional outpatient treatment. Others may need a higher level of care. So,
meaning intake in the hospital? Or
it could be in the hospital, yeah.
Right.
Again, we do inpatient treatment.
Right.
We have a partial hospital program. So it really depends on where they are. It's important to be. It's really important to be assessed both in terms of the behavioral health aspects, the psychiatric aspects, uh-huh. as well as the medical aspects. So it's really important to seek consultation with somebody who really knows eating disorders and has that background in eating disorders to be able to assess all the different aspects of the disorder.
How do they go about finding a provider or a treatment facility they're comfortable with? Because I'm sure, like anything else, they have to feel comfortable with the person they're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they won't come back.
Right.
You
right.
know.
So I think it's important to talk to prospective therapists or physicians or dietitians. And typically, treatment of eating disorders is accomplished with a multidisciplinary team, physician, a dietitian, uh-huh. a therapist. Again, because it has so many different...
It's like a screening process?
Again, they may be able to benefit from that level of care, just outpatient treatment, if, you know, again, particularly uh-huh. if we're intervening early or things like that. But all of the different aspects of the disorder generally need to be attended to. So, you know, talking with prospective treatment providers, what is their approach? How do they work with people? What is the diagnosis that they're giving them, and how do they work with people with that diagnosis? What is their background
right,
in treating
right.
eating disorders? Is this something that they would consider themselves a specialist in, or is it the kind of thing they do this in addition to many other kinds of things? What do they see as the risks and benefits associated with treatment? Things like that.
Do you find that most of the people who you come in contact with are younger, middle-aged?
I would say most of the people that we treat in the hospital are adolescents to young adults.
Okay.
Though we do treat children with eating disorders. We treat children as young as 8, so we have a unique subset there
mm-hmm.
in that we're one of the few programs that treat very young children. We don't really have an upper limit as far as age.
Okay.
But the majority of our patients, I would say, are adolescents and young adults. And that's pretty consistent with kind of the literature on average age of onset and that
right,
kind of thing.
Right, right, right. You mentioned before, you know, we always talk about girls and women with eating disorders. Boys and men, boys and men also have it.
Mm-hmm.
Are their symptoms and treatment different than women? Or, I mean, obviously, you know, not the same sex, but, you know,
right.
is the treatment different because of their men and boys? Or
yeah, you know, the symptoms, interesting, are not that different. They may have a slightly different spin on things, whereas girls and women with anorexia nervosa in particular may be more focused on losing fat and things like that. Men and boys may be more concerned with having a more muscular or toned kind of appearance and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, they may be a little bit different in terms of the focus of the behaviors. But overall, the symptoms aren't that different. The presentation really isn't that different. And treatment is pretty similar. Now, one thing that I think is a little bit different for men and boys is that when you're looking at accessing treatment and talking to treatment providers and thing, I think the awareness of it in boys and men isn't as strong as
right.
in girls and women.
Right.
So they may face some barriers in that the diagnosis. It's possible that it may get missed, at least initially, which could be a problem, especially when we're talking about early intervention being so important. It's
uh-huh.
so important to
uh-huh.
get that diagnosis right away
right.
so that
right.
we get started on a treatment path. So that's something to consider. Another thing is that there may be more stigma associated with an eating disorder in a male because it's kind of a gender atypical disorder.
Uh-huh.
So if you talk to men and boys who have eating disorders, they may feel more of a sense of stigma. And family members may also feel that as well.
Yeah, right, right.
You know, when you talk to family members about that, that's something that some people will sometimes bring up. So you have to be aware of that, particularly as a treatment professional.
Do you find that, for the most part, I mean, I know that not in every case, but for the most part, families are supportive or not supportive?
I think, you know, for the most part, families are very supportive. I think that for a long time, the eating disorders community kind of conceptualized eating disorders as being caused at least in part by family dynamics. And I think there's a real shift in thinking that about that now where, you know, we're seeing the impact that somebody with a chronic mental and physical illness has on the family. And
right.
Of course you're seeing family dysfunction because you have a family in which you have a child or adolescent or young adult or older person with a life-threatening illness. You're going to see a lot of dysregulated emotion in a family
sure.
where you have that.
Right.
And in that sense, I don't think it's different from families dealing with somebody with a chronic medical illness or a chronic mental illness of a different kind where it's not seen as the family causing it. So I think we're
right.
really making a shift in kind of seeing these families as doing the best they can in a very difficult situation. And so treatment now really, good treatment really looks at how can we empower the family, enable to, you know, kind of harness the family as a resource in helping to deal with
right.
eating disorder and
right.
help them to get their child weight restored, for example, or get them to help their child get their symptoms under the control instead of seeing the family as the problem.
Right, right, exactly.
Which is, I think, a really important shift.
It is, actually, you know, in both mental health issues and in, you know, disorders such as you're dealing with. I was just curious, and I know this, I'm like putting you on the spot with this, but... Not really. I mean, you could say you don't know. Is there any kind of a survey that you guys have done for, like, success rate and what it would be as opposed to, you know, I am just, you know, floundering here for a minute, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, is there some sort of a success rate that you're familiar with or that you deal with?
For our program in particular?
Yes, yeah.
We're actually doing an outcome study right now, so I don't have the data
yet.
That?
Okay, see, that wasn't a hard question to avoid.
We want to know the answer to that. We're doing
Yeah, which it would make sense, I would think, you know.
We're doing an outcome study now because what we do know is that people from admission to discharge, you know, do remarkably well in terms of symptom reduction. I mean,
right.
they're able to gain weight. They're able to really arrest a lot of the symptoms that they're experiencing. But it's a very structured program. So what I want to see is, well, what happens
after
a year or 2 years
right.
from them? So that's the piece that we're working on now is we're contacting people a year after they've left the program and seeing where they are and whether the treatment gains they've made, have they been able to maintain them? Those kinds of things. I don't have the data yet.
No,
so
but
we'll
you
have
think
to, we'll you, have to schedule.
Yeah, right. Do you think that they will answer honestly?
That's a really good question.
You know, I mean, I don't think there's many people out there that would like to say, "Man, I screwed up and fell off the program."
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm doing the same thing I did a year ago. I don't know that there's that many people that would do that.
Right.
Now there are some, I'm sure. But I'm not sure that there's a large percentage that would
yeah,
if they did.
Yeah, you raise a really good point, and I don't know that we know. I'd like to think that because we have had a relationship with them over time that they would be motivated to give us, you know, accurate information, and they understand the value of the study that we're doing and trying to figure out, well, what factors are associated with recovery. But you're right. They may not
Is this
want to.
Being done by an outside organization, or is this being done by... You know, your organization.
It's being done by us.
Internally.
They're following up with us.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not an expert, but I would throw this out. Maybe you should shorten the period of checking up.
Sure.
Maybe a year is too long.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it ought to be 6 months or something like that.
Yeah, I think various points are valuable. I think a shorter period of time is definitely valuable. I think a longer period of time is valuable.
Well, yeah,
well.
I think so also, you know, but I think that like in the beginning, if you're reaching out 3 months, 6 months and say, okay, well, then we won't call you, you know, for another 6 months or whatever. And then annually after that. But I think in the beginning, if you wait a year, I don't know, there's just something that, and I'm not an expert, it just doesn't sit well with me. You know, I would want to know sooner, you know, and if there's something that we can do to help.
Like if they're struggling, kind of
right.
Use
you know,
it
come
as
back in and you know,
get people
yeah,
back into
exactly.
Treatment. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
You know, but I just throw that out there. You guys do what you got to do, but.
But also, when someone leaves the our, whether it be the eating disorders or any of our other programs, where part of our treatment plan always is to hook them out with an outside provider.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So we have a relationship with the outside provider that if perhaps their symptomology starts mushrooming up again,
mm-hmm.
they know, okay, and the patient knows, you know, maybe we need to increase your level of care mm-hmm. for a little bit to stabilize you. So when they're discharged from any of our programs, it's not like, okay, thank right. you, we'll see you.
No, but I'm saying, you know, a lot of times they may not respond, you know, if they've fallen off the program and have gone back to previous activity, mm-hmm. they may not respond when, you know, I just, you know, mm-hmm. if you're going to do it over the phone or you may want to do it in person, you know, mm-hmm. so that somebody can visualize them, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And,
right. But you do raise a good point that we don't discharge. And that's
no, I understand that. Right.
Yeah.
No, I understand that, you know, and I wasn't implying that do, you know, but having known and a lot about Princeton House over the years, you know, I know that you don't do that. Doctor, are there conditions that a person may have that looks like an eating disorder but isn't?
Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes we get calls for any number of conditions where the caller says, you know, I'm concerned about my child, sibling, mother, mm-hmm. et cetera. And they need eating disorders treatment, and we go on to talk with them, and it's not clear at all that they have an eating disorder. For example, depression often has an appetite component, so someone who could be very depressed may have lost a lot of weight as a result of being depressed.
Right.
It's not anorexia nervosa. It's not an eating disorder. It's a consequence of the depression, so that uh-huh. can mask itself. Older adults with cognitive disorders will sometimes lose weight and have a lot of difficulty eating or initiating eating, but it has nothing to do with an eating disorder per se. It's a symptom of dementia, you know, Alzheimer's disease.
Exactly.
Like that.
Exactly.
Some medical problems. Sometimes, you know, we'll get someone presenting for an eating disorder and, you know, they may not have been fully medically worked up, and there may be a medical reason for their weight loss. They may
right,
have
things right.
like celiac disease, sometimes Crohn's disease. So there are a number of things that it could also be.
Right. We say that in presentations we give, you know, before you jump to a conclusion that there's a mental health issue, mm-hmm. get all the tests from the doctor mm-hmm. first, mm-hmm. because there are a lot of illnesses out there that the symptoms are pretty much the same as mm-hmm. a mental health issue, like you just said, Crohn's disease, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, if everything medically clears, then you may want to look in to, you know, seeing a psychiatrist or a therapist or something. But, you know, it's true because there's a lot of medical mm-hmm. issues that have the same or intertwined with the same results of, you know, a mental health issue. So what are some the various conditions that someone with an eating disorder may have? Are they pretty much ritualistic with everybody? Are they about the same or
in terms of
well, like if you're binging and throwing up, mm-hmm. is it pretty much the same with everybody that does it that way? They eat and eat and eat and eat and eat, and then they throw up?
You know, I think the way the particulars of any individual, there's a lot of individual variation, I guess,
right.
is what I'm saying. You know, there are certain things that are kind of required to make the diagnosis, so they have to be engaging in symptomatic behaviors uh-huh. a certain amount of the time, but then the particulars often vary from individual to individual in terms
okay.
of what might be some particular triggers for them or how might they express their symptoms. You know, they may
uh-huh.
express differently
right.
in different circumstances.
Right.
So somebody may be okay kind of eating with family and not okay eating, you know, elsewhere. So I think those kinds of things really vary. So I think that's why a very comprehensive assessment and an individualized approach to treatment is really
okay.
important as well.
when you have someone who is cutting, I know when we deal with people who cut with mental health issues, mm-hmm. I'm not saying every time, but a large percentage of time, the people will say, well, if I cut myself, I feel the pain mm-hmm. in my arm or thigh or whatever, rather than the pain in my head. Is it similar with an eating disorder? Or?
There can be some similarities. Sometimes people who, binging and purging, for example, people who binge and purge will sometimes describe it as a kind of calming behavior, so that they describe it as something that that they will engage in when they're feeling very anxious or stressed, and it actually helps to calm them down. It helps them kind of regulate their mood, if you will.
Right.
Like a self-medication,
right,
if you will.
Right.
So there's a way in which the behaviors serve some role for them or serve some purpose for them. And so it's important to really understand and get a handle on that, because if you're engaging in a behavior that works for you, mm-hmm. you're more likely to do it.
Right.
And you really kind of need to have an appreciation of that, so you can help them develop healthier, more appropriate ways of getting those needs met.
Right.
Otherwise, you know, you're just going to, you may either stop the behavior and they may engage in another unhealthy behavior to get those needs met, or it may stop temporarily, but go back.
Yeah, that's
to
what
it.
We find with mental health issues. A lot of times they'll switch to drugs or alcohol, mm-hmm. and we call it self-medicating, you know, and it's not everybody,
right.
You know. I have to say my youngest son is schizophrenic, and he was hospitalized for over 2.5 years. And in and out of hospital after mm-hmm. that, more times than we care to remember. But he never did drugs, mm-hmm. never did alcohol, mm-hmm. you know, smokes. But, you know, and having been a former smoker, I'd love to see him quit, but mm-hmm. and so would my wife. But she never smoked. So her understanding of it is, oh, it's harmful. Well, yeah, it is, but look at his life. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like that's about the only pleasure he has. Let him smoke. I mean, I'm not for it. I'm not condoning it. I would love to see him quit. But, you know, and it's been a proven fact, medically proven, that nicotine quells the voices in the head mm-hmm. of people with schizophrenia. So about 98% of people with schizophrenia smoke, and that's mm-hmm. the reason.
That makes a lot of sense.
So, mm-hmm. you know. Anyway, are there any psychiatric complications, or obviously there'd be medical complications, but is there any psychiatric complications from an eating disorder?
Again, I think you have to look at it
individually. You
know, individually, but also look at what else might be going on. Again, there may be anxiety disorders, there may be mood disorders. A lot of people who have eating disorders are on some kind of psychotropic medication, not necessarily
okay.
for the eating disorder per se, but for any of the comorbid diagnoses that they may have.
Okay.
PTSD.
Okay.
We often see sometimes
right.
with people with eating disorders as well. So there's a number of things we might also see.
Okay, we got about 4 minutes left. I want to ask a quick question, or a couple of actually quick questions. I have a child. He's mm-hmm. a picky eater. I'm just using this as an example. He's
yeah.
a picky eater. Is that a sign of an eating disorder?
That's a great question, and you hear that from parents often because, you know, what parent hasn't experienced the occasional child with a picky who is a picky eater? You know, for a lot of kids, they go through phases. They will only eat, you know, 4 or 5 different foods, or you look at the kids' menu and it's pretty limited. And for most kids, they'll grow out of that. It's just a developmentally normal phase that they'll grow out of. It's a problem if their nutrition is being affected, if
uh-huh.
they're not getting enough nutrients and not getting the right balance of nutrients, if their diet is so restricted that they're not getting the right balance of nutrients, or they're not able to gain weight or maintain
mm-hmm.
weight appropriately,
right.
or things
right.
like that. Or if it's just
as they age, you mean?
As, yeah. Yeah. Or if it's getting in the way of important family activities or relationship kinds of things, where they won't eat, you know, if the family can't go out, for example, because the child won't eat. So,
mm-hmm.
So no, not necessarily. And there's a real blurred boundary between kind of
right.
normal and abnormal
right.
eating in children. But no, not all picky eating is an eating disorder. But there may be some.
There may be some
that
are.
You got to be
right.
aware of.
Sure. Okay. do you take insurance or Medicare or Medicaid, et cetera?
We do take most insurances, okay, as well as Medicare and Medicaid.
That's so awesome.
We take most things.
All right, Robin, how do they reach you?
Okay. Thank you so much. I do want to point out that Mindy's unit, the eating disorder unit, is in our medical facility,
right,
in Route 1. And so she's in the UMCPP hospital that's on Route 1 in Plainsboro,
right,
where Princeton House is its own behavioral health hospital in Princeton. But to reach Mindy, you could call our outpatient number, because what they'll do is over-the-phone interview, kind of tease out the things.
Okay.
So Mindy's saying, you know, like, is it really an eating disorder or is it something else? And these are master's level clinicians answering the phone,
right,
so they really do know how to screen. That number was 888-437-1610. Again, Princeton House Outpatient Assessment Center is 888-437-1610. And then the next step would usually be is to set an assessment appointment. With
it would be with one of our physicians, yeah.
Right.
So they would go through a screening process, and if it looked like,
sure,
you know, it was appropriate to move on,
right,
we would set up an evaluation assessment with one of our physicians.
Well, I can't tell you how wonderful it's been to have you both here. How time flies, you know. you can breathe now. You've been listening to Mental Health Matters, and we have had two wonderful guests. Robin Marks, who's the community outreach person for Princeton House, and Dr. Mindy Parisi, who is director of eating disorders at Princeton House. And what was that number again? Put your glasses on. Hurry up.
It was 888-437-1610. And that's for initial screening, and then,
right,
then to go to an appointment with one of the doctors for the eating disorder unit.
Well, thank you again, and I'm going to have you both back because that was awesome. You've been listening to Mental Health Matters, and remember, folks, mental health really does matter.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
USA Radio News. I'm Kelly Sloan. The U.S. government has asked a federal judge to lift his temporary hold on President Obama's executive action shielding millions of immigrants from deportation. Last week, a district judge issued a preliminary injunction. 26 states have argued the action is unconstitutional, including Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who talked to CBS's Face the Nation about the lawsuit.
What it deals with is an overreach by the president who is refusing to follow and abide by the United States Constitution.
But the issue is front and center in the funding debate over the Department of Homeland Security. The wording in the bill bars federal funds from being used to carry out the president's executive orders. Democratic leaders don't like the language.
When I talk to my friends on the Senate side, they say, go talk to the House. And when I go talk to my friends on the House side, they say, it's not me, I passed my bill. Go talk to the Senate.
That was Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson on ABC's This Week. This is USA Radio News.
What if I told you that you could reverse diabetes and stop taking your diabetes medication? If you or someone you care about has diabetes or prediabetes, there's a special free video you need to watch. You may have heard about this. It's all over the internet. Diabetic99.com. People who have followed this plan at Diabetic99.com have not only normalized their blood sugar, but have stopped taking their diabetes meds completely, with their doctor's approval. Diabetic99.com is a natural, drug-free approach to reversing diabetes with remarkable results in as little as 4 weeks. Diabetic99.com will save you from being a slave to doctor-prescribed drugs. It's easy. Diabetic99.com gives you three specific actions to get your blood sugar under control. And the best part is the main ingredient and solution is a common spice found in most kitchens. Watch the free video for yourself at Diabetic99.com. Watch for free at Diabetic99.com. Get back the quality of your life and free yourself from diabetes medication. Go to Diabetic99.com.
Defense Secretary Ash Carter has made his international debut with a fact-finding trip to Afghanistan. AP correspondent Ross Simpson reports.
Carter told reporters traveling with him on his first trip since being sworn in, We're looking for success in Afghanistan that is lasting. While in Kabul, Carter will see American troops and commanders, meet with Afghan leaders, and assess whether U.S. withdrawal plans are too risky to Afghan security. Many Afghans worry that President Obama is risking an Iraq-like relapse in security by cutting American troop totals in half this year and ending the entire military mission at the end of 2016. I'm Ross Simpson.
The violence continues in Ukraine. A military spokesman says continuing attacks from rebels are delaying the pullback of heavy weapons from the front line under a peace agreement reached earlier this month.